Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. Maybe I should say good evening. No, it's still the Sabbath. There's quite a bit of Sabbath time left, actually. We had a late start due to some rather bizarre circumstances. But here we are, and we even have at least one household is connected, so I appreciate that, and maybe others will join on board as time goes on, and we know others listen over time as they're able to do so. Delayed listening, but they're doing it, and we're glad that they are, very happy that they are. So for those of you who are listening live right now, thanks for listening live. For those of you who are going to listen to this later, we appreciate that you're listening to it later. We are now webcasting or from a different location than normal. That's one reason why we're starting later. I heard about an itinerant preacher, but this is ridiculous. You know, I've also heard about a traveling microphone, but we're doing that today. So we're broadcasting from Orlando, from Orange County, of course, in Central Florida. And I appreciate those of you around the world who are listening and sending us mail. Got a question in the mail recently that I have to answer. There's a couple that I still have to answer. One question got me so riled up, I gave a sermon on it and then wrote an article that I hope will be on our website within a few days. You know, next week, next Sabbath, is the 4th of July. In the United States, an important date, obviously. Now, July 1st is important for Canadians, and I did live a long while up there. Appreciated the time I spent in Canada. July 1st is Canada Day, and then July 4th is American Independence Day. Our forefathers protested against taxation without representation. But they should have seen it with representation. I know that you patriots are telling me you should pay your taxes with a smile. I tried that, but the government wants cash. Anyway, we hope that you will enjoy your 4th of July, and I'm going to get back to that theme in just a moment. I wanted to say something about the fact that this has been a rather eerie couple of days or couple of weeks. We've had deaths of famous celebrities. Seems like several came at the same time, at least in the entertainment world. And one thing that happens with death is that people begin to think about larger issues often. They begin to think about the meaning of life and past, present, and future. Thoughts turn to roots. Thoughts turn to destiny. In some ways, some value comes out of that, you know. I want to deal with a theological issue today, actually. I'm calling this talk because it's based upon what our forefathers said when they began this country. Now, with all due respect, you may have suspected I am an American. We are broadcasting, you know, webcasting from the United States, so I'm going to mention July 4th. But as I said, I know July 1st is Canada Day. For that matter, July 14th is Bastille Day. If anybody's listening in France, believe it or not, there's a town called Kaplan in Louisiana, spelled the same way as my last name, and they celebrate Bastille Day, or they used to. And then July 20th is Independence Day in Colombia, so buenas tardes, you know. But regarding July 4th, Independence Day, when our forefathers completed the Declaration, they ended by saying, with firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. They ended the Declaration by saying that they relied upon divine providence. And I'm calling this talk Faith in Divine Providence. Faith in Divine Providence. Some of our forefathers, ironically, were deists. And so in a sense, for a deist to rely on divine providence is somewhat of a contradictory position. But not of all of them were. I mean, one of them was a clergyman. I'm trying to think of his name, Witherspoon, right, from New Jersey, was, I believe, a Presbyterian clergyman, and he was one of the signers, I believe. But theology, there are really three positions. There are three kinds of people in theology. There are deists, theists, and fools. First, let's talk about the fools. I know that's rather harsh language, but I'm in that kind of a mood. There's been a lot of depressing news lately, but let's go to the first chapter of Romans. A person deep down who has brains, a brilliant person, ought to acknowledge that there is a supreme being, A person with brains ought to acknowledge that. And in the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul deals with that matter. He talks about the intellectual elite of his day, and our civilization to a large degree is based upon that Greco-Roman heritage, you know, that Hellenistic civilization that the Apostle Paul was a part of. And in Romans 1 and verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. You know, more and more I'm beginning to see that concept, that certain people want to not only disagree, but they want to suppress opposition. It's really sad that more and more is becoming the case, where people want to simply mock you, ridicule you, insult you, or not even give you a hearing if they don't agree. Now, you know, it wasn't always that way in this country to the degree it is now. When I was a teenager in the 60s, I was in an organization where we had a, you just name it, and they were there as far as the opinions. One of them went on to become a prominent speech writer for a president of the United States. So you're not dealing with dumbbells there. You know, it was a good quality group of people. But we had every conceivable kind of an opinion. And the idea that we would prevent somebody from expressing an opinion or simply make fun of them so that they would be ignored and disregarded, that didn't enter into our minds. We had knockdown, drag-out discussions on every conceivable kind of subject. And, you know, it wouldn't have occurred to us to not give somebody else the right to be heard. That's just amazing. Anyway, because what may be known of God is manifest to them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and divinity or divine nature. I don't like to use the word Godhead. It makes no sense to me. What is Godhead? I can't. When I figure it out, maybe I can use the word. So if you look at the margin, it says divine nature or deity. So even his eternal power and deity or divine nature. So they are without excuse. Now, this is what Paul says. He confronts them. Now, I don't know what goes on in their hearts and minds, but the Bible does. And the Bible is saying that these people, you know, these elite intellectual types who are very prominent atheists, that they know better, really. That's what it says here. And, you know, the Bible says in the book of Psalms, such people are fools. There are two Psalms on that, 14 and 53, that say that. So I'm not going to go further with that. But there's still a discussion that I think is a fair discussion we can have, and that is between a deist and a theist. Now, many intellectuals are deists in America, and I would say this represents the theology of the American elite. Yes, there is a God, and yes, there is morality, but God doesn't intervene in our lives in a personal way. Divine providence is not a strong concept for them. And it could be instructive if you wanted to study this theology, which you might call the theology of the American elite. It's the theology of Hollywood. It's the theology of Beverly Hills. And you can find it in a series of movies called Oh God, which were supposed to be comedies. But within those comedies is also the theology of the governing class in this country. You know, one time a person described this country as the elite of this country and the rest of the country as a Sweden ruling over in India. You know, we have a very religious, in some ways, mass population and a very secular elite population. But anyway, if you study those movies, you find that they believe in God, and they believe that God is benign, and they believe in ethics, but they don't believe that God interferes. Although he interferes to some degree in the films that you see, but it seems that it's not something that he does necessarily on a regular basis or on a major basis, you know, so it would seem. In one of the movies, he says, I designed the system to work. It's entirely up to you, in one of the Oh God films. And many of our founding fathers were deists. They believed in a God who set the universe in motion but doesn't violate natural laws. But the Bible shows us that God doesn't just put us here and then, okay, maybe it'll work out, maybe it won't. No. He guides and directs human history. It is going to work out. There is a plan, and he's going to see to it that things work out. A belief in divine providence, a faith. I'd like to, there's so many places to go with this, but let's go back to one of the prophets of the Bible, a smaller book of the Bible, only three chapters, but it deals with this particular matter, this matter of divine providence, of looking to God to work things out, finally. So let's go to the book of Habakkuk, a small book, three chapters long. But there's some very deep issues, profound issues in the book, and it's quoted several times in the New Testament. Because Habakkuk wrestled with very major issues of faith. And I do agree that to be a theist, to believe in a personal God, does require a certain degree of faith. One has to trust God. There's evidence of God's existence. There's evidence of God's power. There's evidence of God's goodness. But at the same time, there's also a room for faith. There's a need for faith, for trust, above and beyond what we can see. And there are scriptures about that. Even though I asked you to turn to Habakkuk, with your permission, I'm going to disrupt your train of thought a little bit. I want to go to 2 Corinthians, the fifth chapter. 2 Corinthians, the fifth chapter. Because this is a good scripture to read after what I just read in Romans. Romans says you ought to be able to know there is a God. You ought to be able to know that there is a moral order. But at the same time, 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7 says, "For we walk by faith, not by sight." So here he's saying that, yes, you should know there's a God. Yes, you should know there's a moral order. But at the same time, we walk by faith, not by sight. So that means a person simply going by sight could question a lot of things. He could have a lot of issues unresolved, a lot of loose ends, if he just goes by sight. So it's beyond just sight. There is a certain element of faith, of trust, above and beyond what we can see and experience in our own lives. We have to realize there is a larger picture. We have to realize that we don't have all the facts at our disposal, nor all the ability mentally, all the understanding that is needed. You know, it's not for us to direct our own lives fully, let alone the lives of the rest of the human race. You know, we are free moral agents. We can make decisions. But what I'm saying is we don't really even know what's best for us, let alone for anybody else, in the ultimate sense. You know, so who are we to judge God? And yet all of us have questions. All of us have issues. All of us have loose ends. You know, and that's where faith comes in. If we go to Hebrews, the 11th chapter, Hebrews, the 11th chapter, which, of course, is the faith chapter. Faith is defined as that which makes up for what the evidence you don't have. You have some evidence, but you don't have all the evidence. And so faith makes up for the evidence that we don't have. As it says in Hebrews 11, verse 1, it says, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for." It in effect, provides that support, the evidence of things not seen. So when we don't have the whole story, that's where faith enters in. When we look over human history, we understand there is a purpose being worked out. There is an ultimate end, a goal. You know, ultimately good comes out of it. We have that overview, that biblical perspective, and that provides us with the faith to know that everything is going to work out for the best. I'd like to go now back to the book of Habakkuk, but on the way, or as part of our turning to the Old Testament, I'd like to turn to Psalm 33. Psalm 33. The Hebrew word for providence is hashkacha, and it comes from the root shagach, which talks about God gazing out at the world. He looks out over the world. That's what providence has to do with. Providence means looking ahead. You know, the one who takes care of us, who provides for us, providence. It's interesting that the concept of divine providence is very important in this country. As I said, our founding fathers relied on divine providence when they declared independence. Roger Williams, who created the first American colony with freedom of religion, called the capital of his colony, you know, the major city that he founded, Providence, Rhode Island, you know, the capital of Rhode Island, founded by Roger Williams, the first place where there was freedom of religion. And it's interesting that into that place came one of the earliest Jewish settlements in the United States, in the city of Newport. The oldest synagogue in America is there now, the Touro Synagogue, and which is now a national shrine. And the Touro Synagogue actually received a letter from President George Washington. And to Newport, Rhode Island, came Stephen Mumford and his wife back in 1664, because it was a place where there was freedom of religion. And it was an area where Baptists were able to thrive. And Stephen Mumford was a Sabbath keeper, but initially had nobody to fellowship with. So he and his wife went to a Sunday-keeping Baptist church, and finally, in 1671, established a Sabbath-keeping church. It is said there were seven of them to start with. So there's more of us in here right now, I think, than there were then. Or maybe there's the same number in the room right now. Are there seven of us here? More. Okay, there are more than seven. Hooray. So we beat the Stephen Mumford congregation. And then there's others listening electronically and who will listen later. But he began a Sabbath-keeping church. Now, later on, that group grew, and eventually we had a group that became known as the Seventh-day Baptists, who are still around in America now. So anyway, the concept of divine providence is very much a part of our history. And actually, if you would take out a $1 bill... I hope I have one on me, but if I don't, I'll just refer to what's in the dollar bill. I think I had a dollar on me when I came here. Yeah, I'm going to take out a dollar bill. Now, I realize we're not right now on video, though I hope someday we can eventually go to a video as well. But if you take out a dollar bill, some of you may still have a dollar bill. I realize times are hard, but if you take out a dollar bill, you'll notice that on the back of the dollar bill is a symbol, which is the national seal. Now, I'm not talking about an animal. I'm talking about a symbol, the national seal. All right? That was supposed to be a joke. Anyway, the national seal, we noticed that the national seal has a bald eagle and a lot of symbolism in the seal. And really, a lot of the symbolism has to do with 13, because we are a nation of 13 states that became one. And that's why it says over the stars, over the eagle, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. You know, there's 13 letters in that saying. It's not by mistake. Out of many, one, 13. And the people who came up with this symbolism, they were very scholarly and very biblically oriented, and also some of them were mystically oriented. And they probably knew about the Hebrew tradition that the number one, I'm going to take some time with this, the number one in Hebrew is Echad, and the number one in Hebrew is Aleph Chet Dalet. And Aleph Chet Dalet numerically equals 13. Aleph is one, Chet is 8, and Dalet is 4. So the number 1, Echad, equals 13 numerically. And it's interesting that the American colonies form one nation out of 13. So they were biblical scholars and might have seen some interesting symbolism in that. So they had 13 letters, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. And they had 13 stars in the flag above the eagle, 13 arrows that the eagle is holding, 13 stripes in the flag, 13 leaves in the olive branch that the eagle is holding. And then, on the back of the seal, the other side of the seal, is a pyramid, and there is an eye, an all-seeing eye over the pyramid, indicating that the nation is always going to be built, never going to be finished. You know, we always have to keep building and building, never do finish the building. But overseeing it is the eye of providence. God's providence is over the activity. And so it says in Latin, again, 13 letters, Anuit coeptis. He has favored our endeavors. He has favored our endeavors, referring to God. So it's a phrase coming out of Latin literature. So we have 13 letters, and we have a belief in divine providence underlying this action. So this is the national seal. Now, it wasn't put on our dollar bill. I hope I'm not wrong in this. My understanding is that it wasn't put on our dollar bill until 1935, when Franklin Roosevelt and Henry Wallace, who at that time was Secretary of Agriculture, I believe, later on he became Vice President, they decided that they ought to put these symbols on the dollar, because most Americans were not aware of the national seal and what it looked like. So this made everybody aware of the national seal. Now, the national seal, by the way, uses symbols very popular in the Masonic movement. And both Roosevelt and Wallace were Masons, but then so was Washington, and many other leaders were Masons. So, you know, the Masonic symbolism, a lot of it had a biblical base to it as well. All of that I said as background, the importance of divine providence. I want to go to Psalm 33 and verse 14. From the place of his dwelling, he looks on all the inhabitants of the earth. This is on 33:14. So from this term that God looks on all the inhabitants of the earth, we have this term hashgacha, or providence, the concept of divine providence. And this divine providence involves God's intervention in human affairs. That's so critical in the whole history of the Bible. Not only did God intervene in human affairs, he even became a human. That's how much he intervened. And he suffered and bled and died for humanity. Was the ultimate intervention and ultimate action of love. And that concept is found even in the Old Testament, many places. But I want to go to one. Since I'm in the Psalms, I want to go to Psalm 113. So it's just a few pages over from Psalm 33. In Psalm 113, it says in verse 4, it says, "The Eternal is high above all nations. His glory is above the heavens." Really, God is more glorious than any of the physical creation, even all the stars or everything. He's over all of that. "Who is like the Eternal, our God, who dwells on high?" A unique being who's beyond time and space. And yet it says, "Who humbles himself to behold the things that are in the heavens." Even to involve himself with the heavens is to lower himself in that sense. But then it goes on to say, "Who humbles himself to behold the things that are in the heavens and in the earth." He even humbles himself to behold the things in the earth. But of course, there's a reason for that, besides the fact that he's a loving God, but he also has a plan he's working out here on earth. And he's taking human beings, and as I said last week, converting them into sons and daughters of his, converting them into virtual divine beings in a certain sense. You know, so with that in mind, he obviously is going to have providential care for the creation and for people. Habakkuk was dealing with those issues in his time, and he was dealing with a time in some way similar to our own, where the news was no doubt very depressing in his time, where he was dealing with people who were very corrupt, very hypocritical, where those who were down and out were being oppressed, where those who were in positions of power were, in a way, perhaps thinking in a way that they were getting away with all kinds of shenanigans. You know, it was a very corrupt period of time, and as I said, for a righteous person would be very depressed by the general environment and the kind of news that was coming out at the time. If we go to the book of Habakkuk, the word Habakkuk could come from the word to embrace, and in a way, Habakkuk is having to hold on to God's promises, to wrap around and embrace them and hold on tight at a time when, you know, it's like the famous analogy that my children know about, you know, if a person falls out of the boat and he's drowning, and so they throw him a rope and hold on tight to that rope. You know, that's kind of the situation where Habakkuk has to hold on tight and embrace God's promises. Now, there's a lot of other significance to the meaning of the name, but I could go on and then, you know, not get to the point, not get to the material. So let's get to it. The first problem he has is, my nation is really a corrupt nation. People are sinning. What's going on here? Is there no justice? Are these people just going to get away with this? He says, "O Eternal, how long shall I cry and you will not hear, even cry out to you, violence, and you will not save?" Here Habakkuk is confronting God in a way by saying, look at what's going on around here. "Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore perverse judgment proceeds." So that's a legitimate question. He asks a question. Well, you know, look at the society. Look at all the trouble that's going on. Look at the corruption, the violence, the thievery. You know, what are you going to do? Well, unfortunately, you know what they say, watch out what you wish for. God tells him, I'm going to deal with it, but then he gets very upset about how God is going to deal with it. Because God tells him, your nation is going to be eventually conquered by an oppressor, by a wicked imperial nation that is going to conquer your nation because it has been so corrupt. Well, then he's upset with that. You know, oh, what a horrible thing to happen, which we can understand. Anyway, let's continue reading. "Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days, which you would not believe, though it were told you. For indeed I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth, to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. You know, so they are a proud people. They are people of quite a bit of ability, and yet they at the same time have this tendency to be very violent. Their horses are also swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. And you may recall that in Daniel, they're symbolized by they have eagle's wings in Daniel, the Babylonian, the Chaldean Empire has eagle's wings because it went far, all the way from Iraq down into Egypt, you know, all the way across Turkey and, you know, quite a bit of territory there that they conquered. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, and they heap up earthen mounds and seize it. Then his mind changes, and he transgresses. He commits offense, ascribing the power to his God. So now the Babylonians become arrogant, and they think, you know, they begin to promote themselves and their way of life as if, because they've been militarily successful, that they are, you know, in a sense, better people. Their religion is the best religion. And as we know, for that matter, Nebuchadnezzar eventually got to the point where he was virtually expecting himself to be worshipped. Now, he later on learned that he was a human being and he got a right perspective finally. But this was the Chaldean Empire. Well, now, when a thing like that happens, then now Habakkuk is again upset. How could you allow things to get this bad? All right, I realize my people were sinning. My people, in effect, had it coming, but oh no, what a punishment you gave them. And look at the people you used to punish them. Are they any better? They're even worse. And yet here you are using them to punish my people. So once again, we have a question. We're in verse 12. Are you not from everlasting, O Eternal, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Eternal. You have appointed them for judgment. O Rock, you have marked them for correction. You are of purer eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a more righteous person than he? I mean, he says, I know that ultimately you're going to be winning. Your side is going to win. How can you allow all this to happen? Why do you make men like fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them? They take up all of them with a hook. They catch them in their net and gather them in their dragnet. Therefore, they rejoice and are glad. Therefore, they sacrifice into their net and burn incense to their dragnet. You know, they worship their own power, as I mentioned before. Because by them their share is sumptuous and their food plentiful. Shall they therefore empty their net and continue to slay nations without pity? I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. You know, so of course Habakkuk understood that he obviously wasn't seeing the whole picture. He decided he was going to question, but he realized, you know, that he obviously didn't understand everything. Then the Eternal answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak, and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. So even though history doesn't always work out the way we would like it to in the immediate future, it will ultimately work out. You know, God's plan is going to succeed. God's will is going, you know, will be done. God's people will be vindicated. God's plan will be fulfilled. And this is something that we have to understand and believe in. We have to maintain our belief in divine providence. As I've said, that's what I've called the title of this talk, belief in divine providence. We cannot lose that belief in divine providence. We have to be willing to read these promises in the Bible and believe them. They are going to happen. As he says in verse 4, this is Habakkuk 2, verse 4. Behold, the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. You know, we can endure. We can see this life through from beginning to end if we have the faith. And God himself, you know, can provide that faith, can help us to have that faith. And as we develop our relationship with him, that faith will grow. But the just shall live by his faith. Now let's continue reading. Indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man. And many of these leaders, you know, when you read about these leaders, a lot of them are people who are self-indulgent, and they get drunk. They get sometimes, you know, they get involved with drugs or one thing and another. And he does not stay at home because he enlarges his desire as Sheol, the abode of the dead. You know, everybody dies sooner or later, so death really is never satisfied. And, you know, people are always dying. And this person, he has such lust that it's like death itself. He just cannot, you know, can never be satisfied, as it says. And he is like death that cannot be satisfied. He gathers to himself all nations. He heaps up for himself all peoples. It is amazing about the powerful. Once people have tasted power, they're very reluctant to give it up. It's really interesting. I don't want to comment too much on day-to-day politics. I don't want to get that involved in it, you know. But it really, I remember a phrase that John Gotthard used to use, you know, you have the urge to regurge. You know, it's just, once a person seems to have tasted power, he's just very reluctant to give it up. And even when all kinds of things come out, you know, negative things, they seem to want to cling to power. Will not all these take up a proverb against him and a taunting riddle against him and say, woe to him who increases what is not his? How long? And to him who loads himself with many pledges, will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppress you? You know, that what goes around comes around. It's interesting, you know, when you read about these dictators, what often happens to them finally. I'm thinking about Mussolini. You know, he wound up with he and his mistress hanging upside down, dead, you know, ignominiously. Hitler wound up killing himself, and his whole empire just crushed, you know, that he thought would last 1,000 years, and so on. Verse 7, will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppress you, and you will become their booty? Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you. Because of men's blood and the violence of the land and the city and of all who dwell in it. Woe to him who covets evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of disaster. You give shameful counsel to your house, cutting off many peoples, and sin against your soul. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the timbers will answer it. You know, finally, just all this structure you've built will come tumbling down. Woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Because if it is not of the eternal of hosts, is it not of the eternal of hosts that the peoples labor to feed the fire, and nations weary themselves in vain? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge and the glory of the eternal, as the waters cover the sea. Finally, this is the destiny of the world. These various dictators and oppressors and power-hungry and corrupt people will not be running things ultimately. The righteous will be running things ultimately. And an understanding of God's way of life will ultimately be enlightening the world. You know, this is what the book of Isaiah talks about. I guess I do have time. Habakkuk was very likely a contemporary of Isaiah. He was writing at the time, very likely, when Judah was about to go into captivity. As you read the Bible, the book, it seems that he's writing at the time after the death of Josiah, when Judah was becoming corrupt, and it looked and God was preparing Babylon, as we've said, to conquer Judah. This seems to be the historical context. So there were many other prophets at that time, and one of them was Isaiah. Although he didn't live to see the fall of Judah, he died before then. He was probably martyred by the wicked ruler Manasseh. I'd like to go, though, back to the book of Isaiah, Isaiah the 11th chapter. And that is something that we do have to recognize. Sometimes God's people are persecuted, and sometimes, you know, they even are martyred. But that isn't the end of the story. Because we know there is a future. You know, we know there is a resurrection. We know there is eternal life. In Isaiah 11, let's go to verse 6. talking about the world as it will be when God is ruling and when the saints are ruling, when God is ruling directly and the saints are ruling under Jesus Christ. 11:6 of Isaiah. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. That's the way the world is going to be then. So different from the way the world is now. And this is also symbolic of the various nations of the world that are symbolized by various animals. You know, the Russians are often symbolized by a bear, and the United States by an eagle, and certain countries have certain symbols. The Mexicans have an eagle and a serpent on their flag, and so on. So the various nations of the world are, now they behave like wild animals, but then not only will animals be tame, but the nations will be tame. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. You know, what a different world. We won't have to worry then about our young children being, you know, roaming around. We won't have to be fearful of what harm might befall them. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. I'm in verse 9 of Isaiah 11. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Eternal as the waters cover the sea. Beautiful vision of the world of the future that we find in Isaiah. And that vision is also summarized here in Habakkuk, that same comment as I just read, Habakkuk 2 and verse 14. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Eternal as the waters cover the sea. Now let's go back to verse 15 of Habakkuk 2. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk, that you may look on his nakedness. You know, people taking advantage of others' weaknesses and vulnerabilities, exploiting them. You are filled with shame instead of glory. You also drink and be exposed as uncircumcised. The cup of the Eternal's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory. So the end of these various world empires is to be shattered and to be conquered. For the violence done to Lebanon will cover you, and the plunder of beasts which made them afraid because of men's blood, and the violence of the land and the city and of all who dwell in it. These people destroy the environment. They harm other people. There's a lot I could go into, but I think I'll just leave it at that. You know, there's just so much I could say, but I want to make sure I cover all three chapters. You know, basically, we are seeing here that although these empires rise and have their time when they seem to be very powerful and have a lot of influence on the world, ultimately they crumble, they fall, and they will ultimately all be judged. And unfortunately, a lot of these empires were idolatrous empires, and often they worshipped what they made and didn't really acknowledge a spirit being, a god, but tended to worship the work of their own hands, as it were, their own power. And so we go here to verse 18. What profit is the image that its maker should carve it, the molded image, a teacher of lies, that the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols? You know, and it's interesting, even in this day and age, how many people seem to still rely on lucky charms and various amulets and inscriptions and things. It's amazing, even in quote-unquote sophisticated societies, how much of this goes on. Woe to him who says to wood, awake, to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all. You know, give me a break. Let's not get wrapped up in this kind of thing, in these occult practices that far too many people get involved with. But the Eternal is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Let's understand where the ultimate power lies. Ultimately, it lies with God. Okay. I hope that some of you are hearing the background here. So you see, we have very enthusiastic congregation. You know what we used to say in the old days, you know, no somos muchos, pero somos machos, right? We aren't many, but we are mighty. All right, anyway, now we have a psalm to conclude, you know, now that we've had this basic instruction and this exhortation to remain faithful, to continue to believe in divine providence, even though we have questions, we have issues, we have loose ends. I'm sure a lot of you have questions and issues and loose ends, but you know the basic picture, and keep that basic picture in mind. Keep that vision in mind, because it is going to come to pass. It is going to be fulfilled. These promises will ultimately come to pass and be fulfilled. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Shigionoth. Now, Shigionoth, this word may come from the root meaning to be crazy. Some of you have heard the word meshuga. It seems to have come into English to a degree, coming from Hebrew to Yiddish and to English. So Shigionoth may have to do with a very wild kind of a rhythm, a very wild kind of a music, very passionate kind of a music. So this psalm was very likely intended to be sung in a very intense way, a rapid kind of a rhythm. Now, I believe there's also a play on words here, and there's a play on the word shagach, which means to, as I said, to see, to have this overview, you know, the divine providence. So I believe that when he says, sing this song on Shigionoth, pray on Shigionoth, he's saying, yes, pray to a wild rhythm. But he's also saying, pray about God's providence, about his overview, his seeing what is going on. I believe it is a play on words. O Eternal, I have heard your speech and was afraid. O Eternal, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. You know, I was telling my wife, right now the news is very heavy. There's a lot going on, and a lot of it is negative. And there's one voice, in a way, that is not being heard in a certain way. And frankly, the voice of God's church. You know, God's voice, in a way, is right now obscured. But, you know, people do have the Bible, and they can read it. It's available. People can read the Bible, even though sometimes it's spun and misused, but it's there. But whereas there's all these voices out there, right now there is not a strong, coherent voice, in effect, representing God's church. That's why, you know, Habakkuk's words mean so much, you know, where he prays, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. And that is going to happen. That is going to happen, because God isn't just going to let the world go, you know, go this direction without, you know, having his voice be heard, his representatives telling people what is coming and why and what to do about it. God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. So now he's going back and saying, meditate on the early history of the people of God, this time of the Sinaitic covenant, the time pictured by the season of Pentecost. Keep in mind the wondrous things that happened on Mount Sinai, the great miracles, and how God delivered his people from Egypt miraculously, brought them to the mount, performed great wonders for them, and sustained them in the wilderness, and gave them his law. And keep that in mind. And he talks about Edom, which borders on that region. It's as if God came from what is today Jordan into the Sinai to meet his people coming from the other direction, coming from Egypt across the peninsula. Let's continue to read now. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. Now, there's a dual meaning to this, because we're also talking about a second climactic time, when God gives the law again, this time when the law comes out from Mount Zion, and when God regathers his people in the Holy Land at the second coming of Christ. But there may be a hint here that perhaps God's people will once again first be gathered in that same region of what is today Jordan and what is today the Sinai. There's always been a fascination with Bible scholars in that region, and there has been a belief in that place as possibly a place of refuge for God's people. It's possible. There certainly is a great fascination with that area. For example, in pop culture, you know, the Indiana Jones movies about the adventurous archaeologist. In one of the movies, he winds up in Petra, and the climax of the movie occurs in the area of Petra, which is the area of Teman. Here mentioned. And as I said, if you keep going from that area, then you come to the next area you come to is the Sinai area. So we'll see how that works out historically. Verse 4. His brightness was like the light. He had rays flashing from his hand, and there his power was hidden. Before him went pestilence, and fever followed at his feet. You know, so in effect, God came from a hidden source. The Egyptians didn't know, didn't understand him, and yet he came and plagued them and delivered his people miraculously. and then brought them before him to receive the law. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and startled the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills bowed. His ways are everlasting. So many nations, of course, were startled at the time. Israel conquered its land. You know the book of Joshua. Verse 7, I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian trembled. Cushan is evidently another name for Midian. Midian, it was the area, as you know, where Moses was wandering for 40 years as a shepherd, or living for 40 years as a shepherd, as the son-in-law of Jethro, who was the ruler of Midian, and I believe the priest, the leader of the Midianites. Moses married, as you know, Zipporah, Jethro's daughter, and so this area was the area of the Sinai, and it was shaken up by the events that occurred there, how God intervened so miraculously, and how the Israelites came to Sinai and received the law in a tumultuous atmosphere. Verse 8, O Eternal, you were displeased with the rivers, for your anger against the rivers. Was your anger against the rivers? Was your wrath against the sea that you rode on your horses, your chariots of salvation? Your bow was made quite ready. Oaths were sworn over your arrows, Selah. So he's thinking about all those miraculous events. He's describing poetically how God dealt with Israel's enemies, in delivering them from Egypt and then bringing them into the Promised Land. He's describing it in poetic language. And it's a foreshadowing of God's intervention in the end time to once again reestablish Israel, reestablish his church, his people, and to bring about peace on earth, and peace and prosperity and sanity, really. Verse 10, you divided the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by. The deep uttered its voice and lifted its hands on high. So this is very similar to the Psalms we read that talk about the Exodus and the conquest of Canaan. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of your arrows they went, at the shining of your glittering spear. Verse 12, you marched through the land in indignation. You trampled the nations in anger. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for salvation with your anointed. You struck the head from the house of the wicked, by laying bare from foundation to neck, Selah, from top to bottom. Now, in one sense, Israel was God's anointed. God had selected Israel to be his model nation, and he intervened for them in a miraculous way. And he, in a sense, chose Moses to be their leader. But beyond that, of course, who is the anointed one? You know, the Mashiach, the Christos, the Christ, the Messiah. That's what it means. You know, and so this is really a prophecy of Christ and his victory. So as I said, we can go back and look at what God did anciently and realize he will yet do even more. And ultimately, Christ is given the victory. You thrust through with his own arrows the head of the villages of his villages. They came out like a whirlwind to scatter me. Their rejoicing was like feasting on the poor in secret. You walked through the sea with your horses, through the heap of great waters. You know, so they laid their plots and their plans, and all of their strategy just came down upon them. You know, they literally, you know, had the waters fall down upon them and drown, you know, the Egyptian army. Verse 16, when I heard, my body trembled. My lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered my bones, and I trembled in myself. That I might rest in the day of trouble. When he comes up to the people, he will invade them with his troops. Now, unfortunately, this is very, very serious to have to say these kinds of things, but because the world, unfortunately, as corrupt as it is going to take just a severe, very intense tribulation to, in effect, shake up civilization and shake up the human race, where people will be willing to listen. And so when prophets look forward into the future, even though they know that ultimately things are going to work out for the best, there's also a great heaviness that is there. And you find that in several of the prophets. You find that in the book of Zechariah, and you find that in the book of Revelation. You find it here, you know, that even though there's an ultimate good, an ultimate sweet future, there's also a bitterness that happens beforehand, you know, because unfortunately this is the only way that human beings will learn. There's a Jewish tradition that the Messiah will come in two different kinds of situations. Either there'll be a sort of mass repentance, and that will bring the Messiah, or things will get so bad that only through God's intervention can the world be delivered. Unfortunately, the latter scenario is probably what's going to be the case. Things will just get so bad that God will have to intervene. But when he does, you know, he will turn things around very dramatically, and the contrast will be so stark that many people will immediately understand, you know, God's way is best, not the way we used to be. Let's continue on then. And so Habakkuk, who had all these questions and loose ends, ultimately never lost his faith. He had this dialogue with God, and he winds up saying, I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to have faith in divine providence. I know things are going to work out for the best. I know the questions that I have will ultimately be answered. Though the fig tree, I'm in verse 17, may not blossom, nor fruit on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no fruit, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Eternal. I will joy in the God of my salvation. No matter what may be the temporal conditions, I know ultimately things are going to work out for the best. Ultimately, we will have joy. The Eternal God is my strength. He will make my feet like a deer's feet, and he will make me walk on my high hills. You know, like the mountain antelope that can go up the mountains and can negotiate its way, a tremendous sense of balance. When I see those creatures, I'm so impressed. You know, the mountain rams and you know, that prance up these steep slopes. It's amazing to me. And this is how God will direct our steps through all of these treacherous inclines, you know, the ups and the downs. He'll be with us, and he'll see us through. And he'll see us through to ultimate triumph. And so he concludes by saying, to the chief musician with my stringed instruments. Another way of saying also to the overcomer, to the victor. To the chief musician, also it means to the victor, to the overcomer, with my stringed instruments. So I was thinking that I might challenge my son Daniel. Maybe he can come up with some kind of melody for some of this chapter. Maybe he can put this to music, you know, kind of throwing out a challenge. You know, this would seem like evidently Habakkuk wanted this to be performed. So I'm only going to say it. I'm not going to perform it. I'll leave that to the musically talented. So let's conclude now by going to the book of Hebrews. As I said, the book of Habakkuk, though short, is very profound, and one finds it in the New Testament. And we're going to find it in just a moment. And we're going to go to Hebrews, the 10th chapter, as we draw to a conclusion. And again, I'm grateful to those of you who jumped on board, even though we started late. So in the book of Hebrews, we find, as we get to the end of the 10th chapter, quoting from the 44th Psalm, that things sometimes get very rough for God's people. But yet we know that ultimately, you know, we are on the winning side. So we go to Hebrews 10, and let's go to verse 36 of Hebrews 10. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. And look at who he quotes. He quotes from Habakkuk, what I already read. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. So he quotes that passage in paraphrases. This is probably a Septuagint version of that scripture. Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. For we are not of those who draw back to perdition. You know, we don't back away. We don't falter. We don't doubt these promises, because if we do, we will be destroyed. But rather, we have faith in God's divine providence, and we know that if we endure, as Habakkuk did, we have that wonderful future ahead. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. So indeed, we do believe in divine providence. Well, again, thanks for listening. We hope that you enjoy the rest of the Sabbath. I'd like to comment on the fact that we are now in the fourth month of the year. It's a time in the past when great calamities befell God's church. So there are certain scriptures that would come to mind that might be studied at this season of the year that I'll talk about in upcoming weeks. But on the other hand, it's a pleasant season, the summer, and we can enjoy the summer. I'm not saying that because sad things happen anciently that you should just sort of go into mourning or something. I don't mean it that way. I'm just saying be sober and study the Bible, but at the same time, we certainly pray that you will enjoy the Sabbath and enjoy the summer and enjoy the upcoming American, Canadian Independence Day if you're Canadian, American Independence Day if you're American, or if you're a Sabbath keeper, enjoy the next Sabbath, which is always an Independence Day for God's people. Enjoy this Sabbath and the next one and many, many more. All the best to you and yours.